coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. LGBTQ rights activist Sarah McBride returned to the First State this week to promote her new book.
I'm a Delaware native, born and raised in Wilmington, Delaware. I'm a graduate of Cab Calloway School of the Arts, and I'm a transgender woman.
We'll hear more from McBride about her life and her book, Tomorrow Will Be Different, Love, Loss, and the Fight for Trans Equality. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also sit down with the state's new chief diversity officer to talk about Delaware's efforts to improve diversity and equity in the workplace and in hiring. We also learn more about migrating American eels in Sussex County, check in on what's new at the Christiana Fashion Center, and meet some California college students in the First State this week to help Habitat for Humanity. The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground, is next. But first, the latest news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Governor John Carney signed legislation last year creating the State Office of Human Resources and the Division of Diversity. This came in response to multiple state agencies failing an independent review of their hiring practices and workplace inclusion. In December, Carney appointed longtime HR specialist Keith Hunt, the state's chief diversity officer. It's Hunt's job to lead efforts in defining and cultivating equity, diversity, and inclusion throughout the state's executive branch. Delaware Public Media's Nick Schellino recently spoke with Hunt about his work to date and the challenges that lie ahead.
My position in particular is charged broadly with coming in, addressing a number of the circumstances embedded within the Ivory Report, which broadly speaking have to do with creating a more inclusive workplace environment where people are able to come in to work, feel that they are valued, included, and part of a team. The diversity and inclusion officer also has within my range of responsibility the recruitment function as well as the employee relations function, which are not typically structured under most D&I offices. And I find this uniquely satisfying from the standpoint that most diversity and inclusion, whether it's private industry or otherwise, are more put in a consultative role in order to affect change and participation and inclusiveness. Within my role, having the recruitment and employee relations functions reporting to me, I'm able to provide direct leadership and guidance to the recruitment and hiring processes and practices and results, as well as looking at the employee relations processes, practices, and results as it affects our employees statewide.
Okay, so you're on the ground level day-to-day working with executive branch people who are hiring, and you are directly involved with employee relations and recruitment. Let's talk a little bit about that Ivy report you mentioned. What exactly did that find as far as an evaluation of the culture in some of the executive branch agencies?
Broadly speaking, the Ivy report found that, and I have to speak in broad terms because there are a lot of moving parts to it, but for the most part found that while there was fair, reasonable representation across race and gender, the report found that most of the representation was within some of the lower level grades and classifications. So while you may have, in other words, high numbers, the numbers are stratified in the lower level positions. So there was opportunity to look at recruitment and hiring and in a way that brings in quality people, qualified people, to fill positions as they become available. This is not a numbers game in that sense, as much as we have a turnover that's natural, and we're looking at then as we have that to make sure that we have a diverse slate of candidates as best we can with the qualifications requirements being met, and that we have a diverse panel of reviewers of those candidates to ensure that we have a fair and as equitable process of evaluating the candidates when they come into the door. The Ivy report also spoke to some of the behaviors that were found out into the in the field organizations, if I may use that term, in the agencies, and that there were some cases where people were not treated very well. People didn't feel that they were included in the fabric of the organization or the work teams or work groups, and that there was unfair behavior towards minorities, and that the Ivory Report made strong recommendations, therefore, then, that to shape up some of the HR practices, that it would be wise for the state to combine HR into one unit, because previously all the HR personnel and professionals reported right up to their agency lead, a secretary, even though they were working under the umbrella of Office of Management and Budget. And therein lies part of the dynamic, is that the Office of Management and Budget is primarily focused on management and budget. And the HR issues were left to the professionals to work through for themselves, and working with their agency leads as their direct partners.
It is problematic that minorities are not representative in the higher positions within state agencies. What needs to change in the hiring process to advance different sexes and minorities further in the workplace without advancing people based solely off of their sex or race?
Well, it's a good question. And I've started this job in December, and I'm still uncovering what the moving parts look like. When you ask the question, what needs to change in the recruitment process? So we're bringing in, and I'm specifically bringing in my past experience in terms of looking at lean process improvement approaches to evaluating the organization and its moving parts, and looking at where are there gaps in the the process flow, or the steps that are taking, or the practices that we have had in the past, and how do we begin to look at ways and means to close those gaps. So that is a daunting task, and it's an ongoing task, but it has begun. And I'm meeting with the agency HR people, mapping their recruitment process individually, because each one is different. Each one, again, as I said before, is handled differently from an HR professional standpoint. So I'm meeting them where they are, number one, mapping where they are, number one. And then number two, based on that mapping, jointly looking at where are gaps and opportunities for us to improve and tighten up. Some of that involves looking at how we're sourcing candidates, where we're sourcing them, how we're promoting the jobs that we have. In some cases, our jobs are placed on our Dell board, and that may be more of a passive process, meaning that a citizen would have to come looking for the job and then hope to find a place on that board that meets their career aspirations. What we're looking at now then is how do we begin to more assertively reach out to disparate communities of people and pipeline people and attract them to come work for the government. So some of those things we're putting into strategies and tactics in terms of how do we do more outreach to create the pipeline to attract minorities and women into state government work.
When you say gaps in opportunities, what could that mean specifically?
So, for example, when I talk about gaps and opportunities, what I'm saying is there, for example, we have a circumstance where we are posting jobs on our job board, and we are then therefore passively waiting for people to apply for the jobs. And so the gap is just the fact that we're posting it and passively waiting, as opposed to putting together a assertive, planned recruitment strategy that is reaching out to different target audiences and target populations networking with and professional organizations where we may find qualified people to promote the state of Delaware as a viable place to pursue their career, and then began to make those people directly aware that we have opportunities here to have them directly then go and apply online, and therefore we are more directly and aggressively pursuing pipelining talent to come to work for the state of Delaware as opposed to passively waiting. So that's just a small example, but those are the kinds of things that we're looking at. And while some, you know, your listeners may think, well, you know, that seems obvious, the obvious is not always that obvious, if I may use that phrase, and that there are practices that have prevailed for a number of years, have gotten people to be comfortable and satisfied with that, and now bring a new set of eyes and a new way of looking at how we process through things, and then collaborating with people on taking that look and snapshot, we're able to jointly evaluate that, hey, yeah, there are some opportunities for us to change some things, and how do we begin to think about putting together concrete plans and approaches to making those changes happen.
Is there any kind of timeline as to when we might see a rollout of new recruitment policies in the executive branch?
The big answer to that is yes, meaning that we are expecting to pull together a recruitment strategy after we've done this series of mappings. The timeline is a little loose because we're still meeting with agencies, doing the mapping, and it's a detailed process. So based on schedules and timelines, we're expecting somewhere between the May and June timeframe that we would be able to say that we have an evaluation of what at least low-hanging fruit tactic strategies may work across the board, and or which ones we may work in a specific area to help bring the processes up a notch.
Thanks to the state's Chief Diversity Officer, Keith Hunt, and our Nick Shalina for their time on The Green this week. And stay with us. Contributor Eileen Dalabrida takes us back to the Christiana Fashion Center to update its growth and look at how it fits into new retail shopping trends. That's next on The Green, here on Delaware Public Media. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. The headlines when it comes to retail shopping continue to be dominated by stories of store closures, as online shopping options continue to leave traditional stores struggling. Just last week, Toys R Us became the latest to announce it's finished and will close all of its stores as it heads to bankruptcy. But in an era of crumbling brick-and-mortar sales, there are some success stories. There are shopping centers that are wooing customers with experiences that can't be obtained with a mouse click. One example is the relatively new Christiana Fashion Center. Contributor Eileen Dalabrida has been following this retail hub since it opened in the fall of 2015 and has a look at what's new there and what it's doing right in her latest piece, available right now at DelawarePublic.org. And she joined me earlier this week to tell us more about it. Well, we have looked at the Christiana Fashion Center before, but how has it grown recently? It feels like the name Fashion Center has become a bit of a misnomer for this retail hub.
I would say it is indeed a misnomer. The biggest draw is the Container Store, and the most recent additions have been a spa and restaurants, and most notably, Main Events, a 51,000-square-foot entertainment center.
And was that always the plan, to have this kind of, you know, bevy of different retail and other options there, or was this something that they kind of came to as it developed?
For several years, an entertainment center has been on the developer's wish list. They were very intent on following the strong trend of lifestyle centers that combine retail, restaurants, and recreational vehicles.
So you mentioned this new piece, the main event, you know, an entertainment venue. Tell us a little bit more about it and how it's been received kind of out of the gate here in its first month or so.
Typically, about 500 VIPs show up for the opening of a main event. This one attracted more than 1,000. It was by far their largest opening ever, with people coming out to see 22 bowling lanes, zip lining, laser tags, billiards, more than 125 arcade games, plus a restaurant and a full-service bar.
And this is definitely new for Delaware. Before, you would have to go to a Dave & Buster's in Philly or Plymouth Meeting to have a similar experience. And I mean, that's got to be a draw for both customers and the main event to be kind of in a unique space in the first state.
The folks at the main event say that that was a big part of the attraction. It's their very first center in the Northeast, and they saw a definite gap in the market where they could come in with minimal competition.
I found it really interesting that they have so much centered on bowling, because I guess, you know, the Dave & Buster's model is definitely much more like the video games and those type of things. But they've focused on bowling. Have they had some success with this model elsewhere?
They have. They've tried a number of different combinations, such as a climbing rock wall, which they don't have here, which is something that they aren't putting in. But bowling, it seems to be making a comeback, especially among teens and young adults. And they have a really, really cool bowling alleys there where you can take a selfie and post your picture next to your score.
It's definitely a social game, so it kind of makes sense in the way this venue is set up that you can have the opportunity to kind of eat, you know, watch sporting events, play games, but there is that very social aspect that bowling brings, and maybe some other things don't.
Yes, and you can order at your lane. Servers will come up. There's tables, and you can order drinks, and they'll bring it right to you as you're bowling.
And this is definitely a trend, these hubs that offer an experience beyond shopping in one place, that have the main event Dave and Buster's type of thing, the restaurants, and maybe some other things. This is definitely something we're seeing more and more of, right?
It is. As we see a lot of anchors go dark, there is a tendency, and a very smart one on the part of landlords, to try something else. And Growth Properties, which owns Christiana Mall, has redeveloped 80 vacant anchor stores at other malls in the past 5 years. And of those, only 17 are still department stores. The rest of them are grocery stores, entertainment concepts, or they've carved them up into boutique-style shops and restaurants.
And Christiana Mall has had success with this. It continues to do well, you know, in the face of other malls that are struggling. I guess what I'm curious is the fact that Christiana Mall is doing well kind of helping the fashion center succeed, or is this kind of a symbiotic relationship between the two?
It's definitely a power center. People come from all around because they can find just about anything they want between the fashion center, Christiana Mall, and other smaller centers there. It's really a big draw. I talked to folks who came down from Cherry Hill, New Jersey, where there's lots of great shopping, but they meet family members from Maryland, and they make a day of it. They go out to eat, they shop, they might go to a movie. So that is, it's a regional draw, a definite power center.
And I guess it shows you really can't underestimate the power that tax-free shopping has in this area of the country.
It's made the Apple Store at Christiana Mall the highest volume Apple Store in the country.
The fashion center is managed by Allied Properties, the same group that handles Concord Mall. You reported previously Concord Mall will be reimagining itself in the future. Is it likely the fashion center success may inform some of what this new Concord Mall may eventually look like?
I think so. And the demographic on Route 202 is a bit higher than the demographic at the fashion center. So I'm thinking that might also help them to attract some more boutique-style retailers as they reimagine that space. It will not be a traditional mall. It can't be a traditional mall. It doesn't work anymore. There are only those rare exceptions like Christiana and King of Prussia and Cherry Hill that have attained that lofty status.
You also put together a list of kind of retail trends to watch for us as part of this piece. Let's start with the biggest, the one that is clearly on a lot of people's minds, and that is store closings. What can we expect on that front in the coming months and year?
We're going to see more stores close. Sears and Kmart are struggling. Macy's will continue to close stores, although not at the same rate as last year. Toys R Us, Walgreens, and the Ascena Retail Group, which includes Ann Taylor, Loft, and Dress Barn, has also announced store closings.
Are there one or two other trends that you think stand out? Just looking at the list that you compiled, a lot of them seem to be based on technology and how it's being used to kind of connect with consumers and customers.
Voice-activated shopping is huge. Alexa keeps my shopping list and sends it to my phone.
You have 12 items on your shopping list. Here are the five most recent. Aiken.
Alexa, stop. She just heard her name and she just popped in to recite my shopping list to me. That's something that a lot of people are seeing now. We're also going to see more modes of communication from retailers. We've all been getting emails from our regulars for years now, but now they're going to contact us in more direct modes. I'm already getting Facebook messages from various retailers.
And I think we've talked about this before when we've talked about holiday shopping and some other shopping. There's also a lot of effort to connect with, if you're a brick-and-mortar store, connect with customers while they're in the store and kind of be interactive with them while they're shopping.
Absolutely. We can't get away from them. They follow us wherever we are. We'll also be paying more with our phones, Apple Pay, Amazon Pay, Walmart Pay, fewer checkout counters, fewer people staffing them. We'll also be using QR codes. They're making a big comeback, and that is how we will redeem coupons.
Thanks to contributor Eileen Dalabrida for her time this week. Again, Eileen's piece on the Christiana Fashion Center's continuing growth is available right now at DelawarePublic.org. And The Green continues shortly with an interview with Delaware native and LGBTQ rights activist Sarah McBride. But first, a look at your local news from Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Tomorrow will be different. Love, loss, and the fight for trans equality. That's the name of a new book from Delaware's own Sarah McBride. McBride is an LGBTQ rights activist and credited with playing a key role in Delaware passing legislation banning discrimination on the basis of gender identity in employment, housing, insurance, and public accommodations. And in July 2016, McBride became the first openly transgender person to speak at a national party convention when she gave a speech at the Democratic National Convention in Philadelphia. McBride's book tour brought her to the Delaware History Museum in Wilmington earlier this week, and that gave Delaware Public Media's Kelly Steele an opportunity to catch up with her to chat about her new book and her life.
Sarah, welcome.
Thanks so much for having me.
Hey, before we talk about the book, give us some background. For people who do not know Sarah McBride, let's delve into your background a little bit.
Sure. Well, I'm a Delaware native, born and raised in Wilmington, Delaware. I'm a graduate of Cab Calloway School of the Arts, and I'm a transgender woman. I came out as transgender during my junior year at American University down in Washington, D.C., while I was serving as student body president. And it was through that experience coming out publicly that I dove headfirst into advocacy on behalf of the LGBTQ community more broadly and the trans community more specifically. Worked with Equality Delaware here in Delaware to pass gender identity protections in 2013, because Delaware was one of a majority of states that until that point still lacked clear and explicit protections for transgender people from discrimination. I've been working over the last 2 years at the Human Rights Campaign, which is the nation's largest LGBTQ civil rights organization, working to make sure that we are bringing some of the change we saw here in Delaware to the nation.
Sarah, has this been an eye-opening experience for you? Has it been overwhelming? Has it been difficult?
Well, the experience over the last 6 years since I've come out has been incredibly affirming. It's reinvigorated my faith in the goodness of people. It's demonstrated to me the willingness and courage of a number of elected officials who've been willing to stand up for equality. And it's demonstrated to me that with hard work, we can bend the arc of the moral universe a little bit more towards justice. And then in the last couple weeks, as my book's been out, it's been heartening to see that in sharing my story, I can help open hearts and change minds just a little bit in order to create space for other people to have the opportunity to live as much of their whole life as their authentic selves.
Let's talk about your book, Tomorrow Will Be Different, Love, Loss, and the Fight for Trans Equality. Give us some insight what we can expect when we read the book.
Sure. So the book is my own journey as a transgender woman and advocate, told through in large part my relationship with an incredible transgender man named Andy Cray, who was also an advocate working toward equality for LGBTQ people in healthcare. And the story tracks our relationship from meeting shortly after I came out to, unfortunately, his diagnosis of terminal cancer in 2014. And Andy, who was about 3 years older than me at the time, 27 at the time of the initial cancer diagnosis and 28 at the time of the terminal cancer diagnosis, he asked me to marry him before he passed away. So we married on the rooftop of our building in front of family and friends, and just a few days after that, he passed away. And I wanted to share that story because I want folks to understand that behind this national conversation on transgender rights are real people who love and laugh, hope and dream, fear and cry just like everyone else. And my hope in sharing my story and sharing the goodness of Andy and the love and heartbreak of our relationship, that people could begin to understand that transgender people are quite simply people.
I have not yet read the book. I'm looking forward to finally sitting down, getting some quiet time and reading the book. Where can people get a copy of the book?
Sure. People can get copies of the book online on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, pretty much wherever books are sold. There's also an audiobook available on Audible and Google and iTunes, basically everywhere that you can get audiobooks. And then you can also, of course, pick it up at your local Barnes & Noble or your local bookstore in pretty much most cases.
Sarah, is this your first time at being an author? Is this your first book? And will there be another book?
Well, it is my first book, and I'm 28 years old, and I realize the sort of audacity that comes with being a 28-year-old writing a memoir. But I feel like I've had a lot of life in the last 6 years and taken from that life a lot of lessons. My hope is that I don't have nearly as much life in the next six years, that I don't have nearly as many events, certainly not nearly as many lows. As I had with the experience with my late spouse. But maybe down the road. Right now I'm really focused on this book. I'm focused on the upcoming election to make sure that we're electing more pro-equality candidates up and down the ballot in 2018. And I'm focused on continuing the good work that I've been part of here in Delaware to make sure that every person in the state has not just equality but opportunity to not just live, but also to thrive.
Sarah, as you tour the country, you've been extremely busy over the past couple of weeks and months touring the country, doing book signings and talking to people. What have you been hearing from people at those book signings?
You know, I think one of the most frequent things that I hear is that people are quite frankly scared. They worry whether the heart of this country is big enough to love them too, and they see a president and a vice president who time and time again have sought to undermine equality and attack our basic dignity, whether it's for LGBTQ people, Muslims, immigrants, women, people of color, or so many people across this country.
But what I also hear is that they are finally, for the first time in a year and a half, 2 years, feeling hopeful, knowing that there are millions and millions of people who love them, who see them, who are fighting for them, and that we have a growing alliance of allies whose fight is our fight, and who see us and who are fighting with us, which I think is incredibly inspiring and demonstrates to me that even with the challenges, change remains possible.
With this upcoming election in November, I know it's not a presidential election, but do you see hope that, to quote someone, we can make America great again?
Well, I have absolutely reason to believe that that we can continue to move forward as a country, that we can continue to open hearts and change minds, that we can make progress at the local, state, and still federal level, even in the face of a hateful administration.
Thanks to Sarah McBride and our Kelly Steele for their time on The Green this week. And we continue here on The Green with more on the American eel here in the First State. A couple of weeks ago, Delaware Public Media Science reporter Katie Pikus told us about local work to learn more about the American eel as it migrates to Delaware each spring so we can better manage the species. But there's more to that story than just collecting more data about these eels. While man-made barriers like dams help divert water and prevent flooding in the First State, Katie tells us some of them create a challenge for these American eels as they try to make their way to a freshwater habitat this time of year.
As hundreds of thousands of young American eels arrive in Delaware's inland bays, they encounter a roadblock, dams. Last October, the Delaware Center for the Inland Bays installed a long plastic tube called an eelway near Burton's Pond Dam. It's one of three the center has experimented with since 2005, hoping the eels will use them to bypass the dams. But the center doesn't have much data on whether these devices serve their purpose, so environmental scientist Andrew McGowan decided to track it over the last few weeks, while the eel immigration is at its peak.
If we can get eels up and over that dam, then they have all of the freshwater habitats in Burton's Pond and then beyond.
McGowan wades into Burton's Pond until he's almost waist deep. He approaches an entrance to an eelway and pulls out a piece of unfurled rope connected to a potted plant. It's called an eel mop, and to eels, it looks like underwater grass. If eels are in the eel mop, it means they were right next to the tube, but either couldn't find it or decided not to use it. McGowan admits it's not a perfect system of measurement.
The difficult part is that you don't know how effective the eelway was because it's challenging to get the exact number of eels at the bottom end of the dam without influencing how many eels can actually use the device.
McGowan and Dennis Bartow, another scientist for the center, work to untangle any remaining eels. They put them into a bucket filled with water, then they pour the sample into a net to count them. After that, they release those eels on the other side of the dam. A few miles upstream of Millsboro, they find older eels in their devices at Betts Pond, Maine.
There's more in there. Four.
That's a big guy.
Yeah. Five.
May have been a six that snuck in under the wire.
Well, we'll find out.
Okay, well, it's quick and sharp there. Burton's Pond has more concrete spillway. It's more of a flat, sandy bottom, and there is a lot of glass eels at that site, particularly today. Here, Betts Pond is more of a rocky bottom, a lot of larger boulders, and a little bit of a higher flow.
McGowan and Bartow visit these ponds twice a week. Today at Burton's, they saw 12 young eels in the eel mops and none in the eelway. They're always thinking of ways to improve their devices.
Eel mops are like a totally easy way to pass eels.
Thinking of getting a real big hank of it, having it drape over the spillway, come up through it?
Yeah, something of that nature. Something that lets them go one way but not the other.
As they continue to ponder what they can do to help the eels navigate past the dams, Burton's Pond Dam is scheduled for repairs in 2021. It's part of a state program to help bring older dams up to code. Janice Shute is the state dam safety engineer with the Department of Natural Resources and Environmental Control.
The design standards of today are to build the spillway for a much larger storm than many of these were built to in the past. So we're trying to bring them up so that they can pass these larger storms and not overtop and fail.
It's too early to tell how these repairs will affect the eels, but the Center for the Inland Bays says if it can work with the state so both the eels and the dams benefit, they're open to that. Katie Pikus, Delaware Public Media.
Thanks, Katie. And we wrap up this week's edition of The Green in just a moment with Enlighten Me, where we learn more about some California college students who spent their spring break in Delaware trying to help others. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. This week's blast of wintry weather probably had many Delawareans dreaming of a vacation far away from the first state. So you may be surprised to hear that a dozen students from California State University at San Marcos, just a half-hour drive north of San Diego, actually came to Delaware this week for their spring break. And it wasn't simply to relax and get away from it all. Instead, they were here, battling the elements, to rehab homes for Habitat for Humanity of Newcastle County. Their story caught the eye of contributor Larry Nagengast, who spent some time with the group earlier this week, and his piece on their trip and their work is available right now at DelawarePublic.org. And for this week's Enlighten Me, I caught up with Larry to hear more about it. Tell us, how does a group of students from California wind up trekking across the country and working on Habitat for Humanity homes here in the first state?
Well, on the campuses in the California State University system, there's an organization that's called Associated Students Incorporated, which is affiliated with the student governments, and it's funded in part with the activity fee that students pay along with their tuition, their room and board, and so on. And this group organizes a lot of student activities during the course of the year, and that includes travel and enrichment opportunities during the spring break. For about 15 years, the students at the California State at San Marcos, that list of activities has included working at a Habitat for Humanity site somewhere in the country.
So having said that, how do they choose this destination for the students rather than maybe somewhere a little bit more temperate, so more spring breaky?
Well, the organizers of the trip told me that one objective is to choose a place where students from Southern California aren't likely to have visited before, a place where the climate is a bit different, a place where there are some tourist attractions nearby, a place that's easily accessible by air so the travel doesn't take up too much of their spring break time. The Philadelphia Airport is close enough. Delaware's weather, certainly different, though this week's change might be a little bit more than they had bargained for. And the students were able to check out some historic sites and landmarks in Philadelphia and in Washington, D.C. before they settled down to work in Wilmington.
So what were some of the reasons the students gave for deciding to spend their spring break this way as opposed to, you know, the typical spring break?
Well, yeah, it was kind of interesting. One of the young ladies who was part of the trip said, well, you know, all of my friends are in Vegas or Mexico this week. But their motivations varied. Some had been on habitat projects or had done construction work before and they really liked it. Others thought this would be something new and different for them to do. A couple thought that this would be a bonding experience, working together with a new group of people for a week. They can make some new friends. And some wanted to see another part of the country. But, you know, underneath it all was one common thread. They wanted to help others, to give back to those who aren't quite as fortunate, and they were impressed by Habitat's mission of providing affordable housing for families with low to moderate incomes.
So work-wise, what were their goals for this week? What were they trying to get accomplished in this project?
Well, for students, broadly speaking, it was to learn some new construction skills so they might be able to accomplish some of these projects on their own later on. For Habitat in Newcastle County, the goal was to move ahead with a couple of projects that they had already started. Had the weather been better, the students would have likely worked at Hope Run, which is a four-townhouse project on Wilmington's east side. But the snow made it impractical for them to work on the next step there, which would have been getting the trusses for the roofing in place. So they started out with an insulation project, working on a duplex on West Street in Wilmington, not far from Riverview Cemetery, that Habitat had acquired as part of a foreclosure a year or so ago.
And in your piece, you did tell us a little story, speaking of the weather, about how some of them reacted to the weather we had this week. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, yeah. When I was over there on Tuesday morning, the students had to wait in the other half of the duplex, which another Habitat crew had previously finished a while back, while the city building inspector came in and checked the half of the building that they would be working on before they could start doing the insulation. Well, just as the inspector finished up his work, the students were ready to go over next door and swing into action, and then they looked outside and they saw the snow starting to fall. You know, and for about half of the group, this was the first time ever that they had seen snow. So they rush outside, they pull out their phones from their pockets, and they started making their own videos of the moment. Really, really exciting time for them.
Sometimes we forget that there are people who have never seen snow before.
No, you're right. And this was the case for about half of the group. They just had never been in this sort of climate where they'd seen snow. They've grown up and lived most of their lives in Southern California.
They certainly got their fair share of snow coming here this week. On a more serious note, having volunteers like this has got to be a big deal for Habitat, right? I mean, this is for them to have this kind of extra labor coming in is good news, though.
Absolutely. I mean, Habitat does rely heavily on volunteers. The organization is best known for requiring its prospective homeowners to invest some of this sweat equity, putting in time helping to build their future home or to work on some other projects nearby. But that's hardly enough to get all their work done. So all sorts of volunteers pitch in from time to time. Church groups, college students, teams from local businesses, a crew from a local building construction company helped out with them on a project a couple of weeks ago even. And the Habitat site superintendents, they're used to training these volunteers, showing them what they have to do to handle every task in a project. Now, Kevin Smith, the Habitat Executive Director for Newcastle County, says he gets 8 to 10 volunteer groups that come in from other parts of the country each year. But this group from California had by far the greatest distance to travel.
So how busy is Habitat for Humanity locally right now?
Well, in Newcastle County, Habitat does 12 to 15 houses a year. That's a combination of new construction and pretty much total rehabilitations of other buildings. It also does 5 to 8 smaller projects, you know, major repairs of homes for low-income families. And it has lately branched into some new areas, things like exterior beautification, facade painting, clearing vacant lots, and a lot of times these clearing vacant lot projects end with a community-based cleanup that gets all of the neighbors involved and brings them together as well.
Peace also notes that this branching out that Habitat is doing also includes their work on something else you've reported on recently, and that is the Wilmington Land Bank and some of the work it's doing.
Yes, the work with the Land Bank is still in its early stages. I mean, until the city of Wilmington created the Land Bank, Habitat would have to hold on to the properties it acquired, board them up, protect them against vandalism, take care of all the maintenance and so on, until they were ready to begin work. Now the Land Bank is going to be taking over that role throughout the city. And that enables Habitat to focus on what it does best, which is fixing old houses and building new ones, while the Land Bank deals with the business of acquiring the rundown properties and handling the maintenance until a developer is ready to go to work. Habitat still has a few dozen homes in its inventory, and it has to rehab them before it can maximize its collaboration with the Land Bank. They did swing one deal in the last month or so. Habitat had owned most of a vacant block on East 22nd Street, not far off Market. And they owned all but the lots that included two abandoned homes. The Land Bank acquired those two lots with the abandoned homes and had the homes demolished. And as a result, now that entire block is ready for Habitat to go and start a new construction project.
It's interesting to see how these stories tend to connect from time to time. But I do want to go back as we finish to the students. Did they seem to enjoy their time here in the First State and what they were doing on their spring break?
Well, yeah, I mean, they seem to be. I mean, the weather was, you know, certainly going to be a limitation on their sightseeing. I'm really not sure, you know, how much of Wilmington's great midweek nightlife they were going to be able to absorb. But, you know, they were pleased with the accommodations. They wound up having to stay at a hotel up on Concord Pike, and they seemed to be liking that. They had smiles on their faces. They asked me a lot of questions about the area, things to do and what it was like and, you know, how unusual this week's weather was compared to what's normal. And they were intent on having a good time, come snow or come shine.
Thanks to contributor Larry Nagengast for enlightening us this week. Again, his piece on this group of Cal State students chipping in with Habitat for Humanity locally is available right now at DelawarePublic.org. And that's a wrap on this week's edition of The Green. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. And remember, you can also check out The Green via podcast at our website, on iTunes, and on the NPR One app. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page, on Twitter at TheGreenDE, or by emailing us at TheGreen@DelawarePublic.org. Thanks to everyone who helped make today's show possible. Contributors Eileen Dalabrida and Larry Nagengast. Delaware Public Media's Nick Shalino, Katie Pikus, and Kelly Steele. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Burns saying thanks for joining us, and we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground.